I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of one family's flight from Iraq and one religion which may not survive the war in that country. Walawani is a Mandaean. Believers in his religion place themselves in the Islamic Judeo-Christian tradition. They share some of the same biblical ancestors, but they hold beliefs which are quite separate. Walawani says he was pushed around as a kid, but after the American invasion and after Iraq splintered into sectarian fighting, he says Mandaeans, like himself, were under attack. His brother was inside the family shop when it was firebombed.
It was a horrific time for me. Just watching them, my brothers is burning inside, and I couldn't get in, and people were holding me.
Walla soon decided that he, like most other Mandaeans, had no place in this new Iraq. Only a handful are left. All others live as refugees. I'll talk with Walla about being forced to flee home and religious community right after the news. Much has been said about the cruelty of Saddam Hussein. Whenever anyone in Iraq challenged his authority, he quickly responded with fierce and deadly force. He massacred Shiites in the south and gassed the Kurds in the north. It was possible to at least get by with Saddam Hussein as your president. All you had to do was keep your head well down. And for a number of small religious sects like the Mandaeans, it worked for years. They successfully ran jewelry stores and liquor shops. They lived close to each other and they worshipped together in private. It wasn't a good life, but it was a life. After the American invasion, though, every religion that didn't conform to Islam was at risk, and what happened to the Mandaeans has become one more ugly chapter in Iraqi history. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
My guest today is Walla Wini. He grew up in Basra in Baghdad. He says even when he was younger, it was hard to be a part of a small religious group that was neither Islamic nor Judeo-Christian. The Mandaeans are committed pacifists, and that made it difficult when the Muslim kids called him a Sabian or Subi in Arabic.
نفس الحال. أي مكان نفس الحال هو بالبصرة أو بغداد.
It was always a very harsh childhood. It was tough for us. People always call you that, you know, you are a subbi, you're, you know, an infidel. One thing I remember that the kids would actually circle us and chanting subbi negus and filthy subbi. And so as kids we get used to it.
Did you ever get into fights when you were a young boy?
No.
Yes, I did, actually. And one, maybe I'll stick to my memory because it was big for me that I get into such a fight. Was when I was 17 years old. It was in 1987. And one student came to me and he said, you know, you are a filthy Mandaean. And it got me very upset. I actually charged and started fighting with him. And I got into a big fight, a physical fight with the guy. And I was very upset myself that I had to get into the fight and upset that what he told me. And you know, I'm 17 years old to be insulted like that in front of everybody.
Now, well, I don't know that much about your religion, but one thing I know is that all Mandaeans are supposed to be pacifists. You're never supposed to raise your hand.
Yes, I agree, and I think maybe that's why I was upset with myself. But as a teenager and being insulted like that in front of people, I know it was, you know, prohibited for me to do so, but I had to fight. And now when I look back into it, I would wish I'd done it differently.
I suppose you were punished by your parents?
Yes, I suppose so. Yeah, well, my dad definitely was very upset, and he always said that, well, you know, this is their way of thinking, and we shouldn't be, you know, to their level. But I'm a teenager, and you know, to be insulted like that in front of people, I couldn't help it at the time. So I guess I'm sorry that I did it, but I wasn't sorry at the time.
Did you win the fight?
I did, and I felt good that, you know, I slapped him, basically. That's the whole fight was, you know, I slapped him, and then we just, held each other, you know, and pushing each other. But, you know, the thing is, when I slapped him and I told him that, you know, we are cleaner than you, it felt good.
I've spoken to people who grew up as Christians, people who grew up as Jews in Iraq, who say that, you know, it was a little bit difficult, but it was okay. You know, we weren't picked on all the time. Was it more difficult for you as Mandan?
I guess it was harder for us than maybe, you know, Iraqi Christians, because there is, I think, more support to them as our religions that have been accepted by the Quran. The Mandaeans are not. The Mandaeans, still, it is debatable for Muslims. A lot of Muslims say that, you know, we are infidel and we are not people of the book. So, yes, we had a much harder time than other minorities in Iraq.
Tell me a little bit about the way that it was difficult for your family, though, for your mother, for your father, just to live as Mandaeans in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. This is before the war. Was it always a matter of watching over your shoulder, of being careful where you worked and who you spoke to? How difficult was it?
It was very hard for my parents. We grew, you know, knowing to keep quiet and you know, you don't answer. I guess we have a saying that, you know, we say you walk by the walls or close to the walls. So, you know, nobody would see your shadow. I guess that is the idea. You don't go out in the open. And it was tough. You know, my mother would used to go, and I remember that, used to go to the market and shop. And they would tell her that, you know, she can't touch. You know, they would tell her that, you know, you are a filthy Mandaean. You can't touch the produce or, you know, the fish without taking it. So she would actually only tell them from far that, you know, I need that piece or you know, that fruit or that vegetable. And they will pack it for her and put it in a bag and then give it to her. So she can't touch it. And if you'll touch it, they will tell her that now it became unclean. So you have to take it. Huh. And my dad, when he used to work, he used to, hear things and not say anything. He won't answer it back. So he would just swallow it, as we say. Because, you know, you can't do anything about it. And it is much more dangerous to actually say anything or do anything because then they will retaliate against you. And so if you don't say anything, people will say whatever they want, and then they move on. And you know, you go and continue what you were doing.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Walawini belonged to a small religious sect in Iraq called the Mandaeans. And he says Iraq went from being an awkward place to an impossible place after the U.S. invaded. Because that's when Islamic fundamentalists, Sunni and Shiite, began to make life intolerable for the Mandaeans.
It definitely turned upside down for us. For a small, peaceful minority, it became a lawless land. No laws, there was no protection, there was no government, there was a complete destruction of all infrastructure, and it became very dangerous for us. And a lot of bad people appeared in the streets. Gangs started eventually to take more of a religious kind of direction. And a lot of people who actually attacked Mandaeans, they were telling us that, you know, this has become an Islamic country and there's no place for you as an infidel in this country anymore. And it's not only Mandaeans. Actually, we have a lot of our other friends, which we thought they are much more or better protected, you know, Christians, the Yazidis, the same thing. It became very hard for everybody. Maybe, you know, for the other minorities who had an enclave, they went up to the north where they do have lands and they stayed a little better secured. But for us, it got worse and worse, and then became kidnappings and killings and, you know, forced conversions.
Forced conversions? What's that?
These fundamentalists, they were really terrorizing people, and they were forcing them to convert. And basically, they tell them that you have to convert to Islam. This is, you know, the religion that you have to follow. You know, they would actually take, you know, people and force them to convert to Islam. Some actually would circumcise them. And in Mandaeanism, there is no circumcision. And so the person who would be circumcised would not be a Mandaean anymore.
Could not go back to being a Mandaean, is that right?
yes. And if they prove that to the case that it was done by force, then he won't be able to produce. He won't be able to get married. So it is a very sad story.
This happened to friends of yours, Wala?
تعرف أحد إنه انجبر إنه ختنه؟
Yeah. Was it? أخو زوجتي.
Yes, my brother-in-law.
Was he married at the time?
متزوج بسوريا.
He just got married actually, and he was kidnapped first, and then they circumcised him, and then they told him that now you are circumcised, so you have to become a Muslim, or we're gonna kill you. After they released him, after they circumcised him, he went home, and then he managed to actually flee the country and go to Syria with his wife. And he was there for 6 months. He couldn't stay in Syria long, so, and he was so terrified that if they know about him, they will kill him. So he actually smuggled himself to Sweden.
Well, now, what happened to you? What was it that forced you to decide that you had to leave, that you had to get out of Baghdad?
أنا بداية حديثي قلت صاحب محل مشروبات في السيدية.
I owned at that point a liquor store in Saidiya, in Baghdad. And we knew that things were going bad for us, and we're very careful, and we're worried that something pretty bad gonna happen. And sure enough, on November 20th in 04, a gang, actually, an armed gang, came to the store, and they forced themselves in, and they were shouting and screaming at us, death, you know, your end. They threatened us that we have to close the store and give them money, that we have to convert to Islam. And so we took that threat. We were terrified, and we went to the police the same day. And so the police, you know, some said, well, you know, don't worry about it. Just close the store and go home. And, you know, maybe, you know, you shouldn't open the store for a while. And another policeman actually said, you know what? I think the guys were right. You guys, you should convert to Islam. And I think that would solve the problem. Because, you know, you are Serbians. So why not be, you know, change and be Muslims? Just convert.
Was this the time when you realized that you weren't going to get any help from the authorities at all?
Yes. We figured that, you know what, if that is what the police is telling us, then it is serious, and I think we are now deeply threatened and in trouble.
Wala Wani and his brother had tried to keep that small liquor store running as a way to feed the family. It was a decision which cost his brother his life and forced Wala to flee the country. And I'll talk with him about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Wala Wani is from Iraq. He's a member of a small religious group called the Mandaeans. They're often called Gnostics. Their faith shares some features of Jewish mysticism. This is the sound of a Mandaean priest at prayer. At the time of the U.S. invasion, there were perhaps 60,000 Mandaeans living in Iraq. Today, there are only a few thousand left. My guest, Wala, and his brother, Dia, had been trying to run a small liquor store, but Islamic extremists told them to close it. The police were offering them no protection, so the brothers decided to close the shop. Wala took the job of loading up unsold liquor to return it to the creditors. His brother, Dia, remained behind to guard the remaining stock and to wait for his brother.
My brother stayed behind in the store, and we heard this huge explosion, you know, in the neighborhood. I right away got terrified, and I thought, you know, my God, I have to go back to the store. And so I did, and went in, and I can see the store that was burning. And my brother was inside the store.
What had happened? What did you find out?
You know, we got to the store and there was some people actually outside, and because, you know, the content of the store, you know, with alcohol and you know, liquor and all of that, there was a lot of fire in the store, and it was a horrific time for me. Just watching them, my brothers is burning inside, and I couldn't get in. And people were holding me because I wasn't able to get into the store because of the intensity of the fire. And finally we managed to get into the store, and some standing by people were actually helping. We got in and we dragged him out of the store, and he had burns, 50% of his body, second degree burns, and he was in pretty bad condition.
They got him out of the store? Did you get him to the hospital?
طلعنا من المحل ونقلنا إلى مستشفى الكرخ العام.
Yes, we managed to get him out of the store, and we immediately transferred him to the hospital.
Were you able to get into the hospital to see him, ولا؟
رحت.
Yes, as risky and as dangerous for us it was, twice get to the hospital, and he actually told me the last thing he was telling me that. You have to get out of here. You have to save yourself and your family. Take everybody and leave the country. They are going to go after us, and they are serious on killing us.
Did you know the last time that you were speaking to him that you wouldn't see him again?
هل كان في مخيلتك إنه راح تكون هاي آخر مرة كان راح تشوفه وتحكي وياه؟ لو تصورت إنه راح ترجع وترجع تشوفه؟
لا، كان مؤكد إنه ماكو حياة لأن جسمه صار لونه.
Maybe not thinking of, but he didn't look good to me when I went to see him in the hospital. His body was turning greenish black, getting, you know, infections all over. It was very hard to see him, and it was tough for me, you know, to even think that maybe this is, you know, the last time I might see him, because he didn't look good. I was told that after I left, his kidneys shut off, and then thereafter, he died.
The cemetery where Wala's brother Dia was to be buried is near Abu Ghraib. The family was not even able to give him a proper burial. They were restricted in the number of cars they could take there. At this point, Wala and his own wife saw they had to get out of Baghdad.
من صارت هاي بعد شنو تفكيرك كان هل إنه خلاص لازم نطلع؟ We have to leave Iraq as soon as possible. But my wife was pregnant and she had a very hard time with her pregnancy. And we were advised by the doctors that we shouldn't take the risk and travel this long trip from Baghdad to Jordan by road. It takes, you know, almost 12 to 14 hours. So I had to wait for a couple months before, you know, decided to actually manage to leave. But at the same time, it's the whole family, all of us, we sat and we decided that they are going to go after us. And the threats continued to come to my family, and that they told them that we killed one infidel and we're going to kill the second one. And it was me. I know that they won't stop. They would go after, you know, my other brother and my family. And so the first thing I did is actually to move out of my parents' house, because we lived together when things got bad. So at least we are as a group. But when things happen like that and the threats, so I decided to move out for a couple months and go in hiding till we get things settled and my wife can make the trip and the journey to Jordan.
Well, I don't want you to take my next question as in any way disrespectful, but I'm wondering if at that time you or your family or any of your friends thought, you know, we're going to die here if we insist on continuing our religion. Maybe we should just convert and, you know, and use that as a way of getting out. Did that ever cross your mind or anyone else's mind?
No, it did not cross my mind. This is not the first time. We've lost people, and I'm not talking in a historical perspective. My other brother was killed in the war with Iran, and although we shouldn't be actually drafted to the military, And they did draft us, and my brother was killed. And we could have left at the time, but, you know, still we thought, you know, it's our country, too, and we have been here for a long time. And when they killed my other brother now, and we looked at it, I was like, if I would change my faith, I would be a person without dignity, without a soul. And I thought, you know what, if before me the fight was worth it to keep it in my faith, then I'll just continue. And we did.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. While Awani did indeed make it out of Iraq, he was living in Jordan with his pregnant wife, but even with the United Nations protection, things weren't much better.
I had some cash with me when I left, so I managed to live for a little while, you know, in a very modest, a very small, little tiny room with my family. But eventually, when I had my second child, we didn't have enough money. And so I found this job that I worked there for a very short time. And people knew because they asked me and they figured out that I'm not a Muslim. So I said, well, you know, I'm a Mandaean. And they start, you know, telling us that you are an infidel. And so I tried to keep quiet because I was worried, you know, I'm in a foreign country and I'll be thrown out of the country. And that's exactly what they did. They went and they talked to the immigration police. And they told them that, you know, I'm illegally, I'm in Jordan. And next day, the police came and raided the factory and took me. And for 3 days, I couldn't contact anybody. I've tried to convince them that, you know, I am legal. I came with a visa, and I do have my papers, and I have actually applied for the UN, and I am under the protection of the UN. And they didn't want to listen. And eventually, my wife and I was looking for me, and she didn't know where I was. And finally, she knew that I was arrested, and she got the UN actually on board. And 3 days later, they got me out of jail.
Although Wala Awani and his family were living as refugees in Jordan and waiting for permission to move to the U.S., they still had family in Iraq. Two of his brothers still in the Baghdad area.
It was as hard and maybe even worse. My brothers behind me, they stayed behind and they tried to consolidate what we have. And my brother Karim, he's a jeweler. So they decided to take what they have of gold and sell the gold to prepare for the trip to Jordan or Syria. It basically, you know, when you go to these countries, you will live on what you have. And that's the only thing we can sell. You know, you can't sell anything else. You can't sell a house or, you know, anything. So this is, you know, a quick commodity, you know, that you can actually sell the gold. And on June 21st, that day, actually, they were deciding to go in and sell the gold. And they were followed by a group of people who attacked them, and they start shooting at them and the car. They injured my brother Karim in his right leg, and they destroyed his leg. Actually, was multiple fractures. They didn't kill him, but they took everything they had, all the money and the gold that they had in the car, and they left them. And they were actually shouting and screaming at them when they came in to take things from the car. That, you know, you're infidels, you know, you didn't, doesn't deserve to live.
Did your brother survive?
هل أخوك عاش وراء الاطلاقات هذه النارية؟
أي عاش
نقلوا
المستشفى.
Yes, he did survive. He bled, was pretty bad, but managed to get him to a hospital, and they fixed his leg, and he decided that he has to leave Iraq. He can't stay anymore. So after 21 days, he actually talked to the doctor, and he told him that I have to leave because, you know, they're going to kill me. And the doctor told him that, you know, I think you can make the trip if you have to. So he did. He actually fled Iraq on July 14th.
And he made it to Jordan.
Yeah. Yes.
Is there anybody in your family who's still in Iraq?
أكو عندك أحد بقى من عائلتك ببغداد؟
باقي أختي ببغداد لأن ما تقدر يعني.
I have my sister with her family actually left behind, and we're very upset and disturbed about it. We're trying to help her. She moved around in Baghdad in hiding when she was there for a little while till we managed to actually arrange things for her to get her out of Iraq. And then we did get her to Syria. And then when she got into Syria, she stayed there for a little while. But things are tough there. You need a lot of money, and they don't let you work, and you can't do anything over there. Eventually had to go back to Iraq, and although we didn't want her to do so. They're trying to find a place to hide. So they did the same thing. They moved around. And, of course, they don't have anything, so they were light to move around. And they end up going to a small village in the north called Beledruz. And they stayed in Beledruz for a little while. And then when people knew that they were Madayans, things start to get hard and harsh for them. So they decide to move again. And they moved now. They are in another small area called Kalar. At least they are safe. They are not happy. They are, struggling to survive every day. And we're trying to get them away out of Iraq.
Wala Wini is a Mandaean, a faith whose members have been under attack in Iraq from Islamic extremists. Wala is now in the U.S. with his wife and two sons. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. One observer calls the persecution of the Mandaeans a religious extinction in the making. I asked Wala what he thinks will happen. Does he think his faith, that the Mandaeans, will disappear?
They were at least some Mandaeans. I mean, in Iraq, and we live there. Now there is only a few thousands and maybe only a couple of thousands left behind. And I think there is no future for us left in Iraq. The whole community left, and who left behind is the weakest of us. And we are working hard, and we're seeking help to find a new place, maybe, a new country, to get all back together and live our lives, peacefully, the way that we did for thousands of years. We lived in peace, and we didn't hurt anybody. And now we're looking up to the world to find maybe a place for us to have us again as a community.
You've been telling me, Wala, that friends and family have gone to Sweden and to the U.S. and to Syria and to Jordan. I'm wondering if you fear that this scattering of Mandaeans could also mean the end of the religion itself.
Yes, and this is my greatest fears. And being scattered, all over the globe, it might be the end of this religion after thousands of years that survived everything. And the Middle East, and now, after they got themselves, to the free world, it's sadly if they're going to actually disappear like that. But you know what? I mean, we are a very small, very tiny minority. And if you're talking about, only these few thousands, or maybe 10, maybe 15,000, that's all what is left behind. And if we can get them into, this country, they might actually survive. You'll be surprised. This religion was tough religion that managed to actually survive through these, thousands of years. It would, if it gets a chance, another chance, they might actually survive and revive themselves.
I can't decide if you sound really determined or just really hopeful.
يقول مدى أقدر أعرف إنه هل أنت تصور يعني دا من صوتك هل إنه أنت مجرد تتمنى. I can tell you that I am determined and we are determined. There's a lot of hope into it too, but we have to survive. I know it sometimes it looks like a dream, but when I look back and it's still raw, it's fresh. I mean, I can look back and I see still I have my family, I have relatives, friends. They are still in Jordan and Syria, and they are scattered, and they are every day, somebody actually trying to rescue themselves maybe just by taking those huge risks and smuggle themselves through these dangerous roads and to go to Europe. But you know what? They're going to be scattered. We won't have a community. That's why, we are working hard to say, take us all as a group, let us live back as a community. And I'm worried. I'm worried about my children, the coming generation. If these kids, they would have no community they won't be any Mandaeism anymore. It's very hard to teach old traditions without having our priests our temples and our people together.
And so what do you tell your eldest son, Ivan? He's a little over 2.5 years old now. You tell him that you're still in search of a home, that you're here in the U.S. and your home, or that your home is in Iraq and someday that you'll go back. How do you explain it to him?
Maybe harder, better than you saw the no.
This is home, and I think it's hard for me. I just came here now, and I'm looking back into Iraq and look at my little child. I say, you know what, he's going to be an American. I'm still going to always have my dreams and connections with Iraq still fresh, and I always think of it. That's a place where I had maybe tough times, but still it was, home for me for a while. And now I feel that maybe this is where it's going to be home. This is where I can feel that I'm safe and I can raise my family and my kids.
Well, Awani now lives with his wife and two children in the U.S. He talked with me from a studio in Boston. Special thanks to Wissam Brigi, who did the interpreting for my conversation with Wala. In just a moment, I'll return to a series of stories that seems to be taking on a life of its own here. I've talked with people who have done away with their television and others who are finding different ways to soften the footprint they make here on the planet. How about ditching the family fridge? Could you do that? I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Last week, we heard the story of selling the family television. Steve DeJoseph was sitting in his comfy chair and watching a Celtics game while his wife was trying to run a yard sale. His wife walked by, made a disparaging comment, and that prompted Steve to act.
And I really didn't give it a conscious thought. I walked over, unplugged the television, unplugged the antenna. In the middle of the game, and I wheeled it from the family room out into the garage. And as I'm pushing the television towards the front of the garage, this Volkswagen Rabbit squeals into my driveway, and he opens the door, and I'm still pushing it, and he says, "Is it for sale?" I kind of looked at him, looked at the TV, and I said, "Yeah," and never gave it a thought. I just said $165. Looks at the television, he says, "Deal."
My next guest is Dave Owen. Dave heard Steve's story and smiled.
I've never been a big fan of television, and I had three children, and as we grew up, they weren't big fans, but they were, they made their use of it occasionally, and so we decided it would be at my 50th birthday we would get rid of the set.
Was there a ceremony
attached to this? Not really. If there was, I can't remember, but just a sense of relief that it was done, and that was 6 years ago, and I will never go back.
But Dave had written to tell me that he'd chosen to get rid of another major appliance. Something I thought most people couldn't do without. Dave says 12 years ago, he sold the family fridge.
I also had three girls, and as they became teens, they also were dancers. And they were very weight conscious, as most young women dancers are. And we were vegetarians, but we still had ice cream and cheese in the refrigerator and the freezer. And they began to tell me that couldn't stay there because it was too big of a temptation for them. And so after hearing this for a year or two, I realized, if I can't have this around, what's the point of having a refrigerator? We don't eat meat, and if we're not going to do dairy products either, let's just get rid of it. So at one point, I believe it was 1995, I asked a used appliance company to come in and take it away and give us a few bucks for it. So it went out the door, and I would say more of our friends were shocked by that than they were about the television, because actually I know a few people who have gotten rid of televisions. They're quite happy. It's not that uncommon. But refrigerators, I don't know anybody yet of my community that's taken that step.
It's more like television is a moral decision, but the refrigerator seems like an unusually practical or impractical appliance to get rid of. Right. Were you surprised after the fridge left at how that changed your life?
It didn't change it a whole lot. Actually, probably changed it less than because I wasn't using it very much. It was an empty refrigerator, really. I mean, for years, we just didn't use it much. So, no. But there was another thing going on at the time, too, as I was developing my skills as a naturalist. I realized that my ability to hear subtle sounds in nature, calls of birds and frogs and insects, the movement of animals, was very important to my personal work as well. And I realized that the moment that refrigerator was gone, there was a silence and a peace in my kitchen and actually my whole house that I'd never noticed before. I'm very aware of any electronic sounds or buzzes or vibrations or motors now. And that's just a part of my deliberate training and as a naturalist to be aware of natural sounds, and non-natural sounds disturb me and interfere with that process. And so especially the sound of insects, which are probably the most subtle of all sounds to listen to. In my home, I like to sleep with windows open in the spring and the fall and the summer, and without the rumble of a refrigerator, it's much easier to hear crickets and katydids and grasshoppers call, and I find it much more aesthetically pleasing to not have that rumble in my house. I actually wasn't consciously thinking about that, I think, at the time of removal, but quickly I realized this was going to be a big benefit. And I soon realized when I entered my friends' homes and my parents' homes and others around me that one of the first things I noticed was the rumble of a refrigerator. And these days, you know, in the last decade or two, refrigerators become monstrous. Many people have huge ones. And the sound, yes, and the sound of that appliance is quite disturbing. And so now I quickly recognize that and tend to move away from them if I'm around them in the house. So that was another great benefit of having a refrigerator gone.
But didn't it mean that you had to also change the way that you prepared food? I mean, you couldn't
a little bit.
Go and buy vegetables and leave them in the refrigerator until you needed them, right?
Well, we had to test that, and we found that vegetables generally keep a day or two or three or four days without any problem, especially if you learn how to move them from inside the house to outside the house in the cool, if it's fall, winter, or spring. There's plenty of cool weather outside where you can keep things. So we learned to move things back and forth, and that may sound troublesome and worrisome to someone not familiar with this process, but we took it on as a fun challenge to see if we could beat the system. So it was a welcome to try to develop a strategy of moving things in and out. And we realized that we really did not have to make any special trips to grocery stores whenever we went out for work or any other reason. We could always stop by and pick up things coming or going.
Did you find that your consumption then shifted in a way back to what you would have been more accustomed to when you were living in the Middle East, where a lot of people don't have refrigerators, and they'll pick up the bread that they need or the vegetables that they need on a daily or every other day basis?
I think it did, and that prepared me for that transition possibly better than the average American. My years of living more simply in many cultures of the world where refrigerators have not been or still aren't, there's a process of learning how to dry foods and use temperature variants to keep them. Like in the Middle East, we would get yogurt in a rock form where it was already dried in the sun and would be as hard as a rock. You could pick it up and you would see it in chunks in the marketplace. You bring it home, you keep it forever. It didn't have to be refrigerated. It can be hot or cold. And when you want to use it, you just pour tap water over it and massage it a little bit and becomes a gooey consistency like most of us are used to with yogurt. That's just one example of many things that these traditional cultures do without refrigerators. So now instead of a refrigerator, we have a big cabinet with shelves on it, a closet-type cabinet where we keep our dried foods that we stock up on.
Tell me something, though, because people listening will be thinking, you know, would I have the time in my day to spend, you know, that extra energy on food preparation? Because the fridge allows me to zip something out of the refrigerator or the freezer, defrost it, eat it, you know, and because that's what's happened is that our food preparation time, our refrigerators and our microwaves and our stoves allow us to spend less and less time preparing food, and in part we look on that as a luxury, as an advantage. You're saying you don't see it that way.
I have an answer to that. Instead of watching television and movies and videos, we prepare food. So, you know, the dispensing of the television has given us definitely more evening time to work on food. But I wouldn't say that we spend an excessive amount of time. One of the things we've done this fall and for several years now is collect acorns in the fall. And there's a process that's very fun and entertaining that we spend a number of evenings on, and collecting the acorns, cracking them, boiling them, drying them, grinding them up into flour to use in vegetable burgers as one of the ingredients of vegetable burgers we make, and also in pancakes. So things like that, you know, without television and modern media, visual modern media to be so obsessed with, we spend time in creative preparation of food.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Dave Owen and his family took it upon themselves to get rid of their refrigerator. Dave says the change in preparing food became quite a different kind of social affair. I asked if any of his friends gave or give him a hard time.
No, nobody does. Most people are considerate about it. And like I said, I've yet known anybody in my community that has taken that step. But I think it's fun to challenge people with that idea. So that's okay. I'm not a missionary out to change everybody else's opinion on the subject. And I think even people that aren't vegetarians would find that it's not that much more work to keep a kitchen without a refrigerator. This, you know, meat will keep for a day or two. And if you move it inside and outside, it can keep for longer. And, of course, there's an energy element. I can't remember exactly how much money I figured out. I did try to make a calculation back in the mid-90s. Seems like we were saving $7 or $8 a month on electricity.
Be a lot more now.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of save and pride in that you're making some small contribution in the realm of energy conservation there.
Your girls are off at college now?
Well, they're actually long off now. They're on their way in the world.
Uh-huh. Ever have a thought about getting a small refrigerator or an ice box
yes,
or a cooler?
Yes, we have thought about that possibility, but we haven't done it. But not recently. In the initial years, yes, but not recently. I can't imagine any reason that would cause us to return to a refrigerator. It's become such a sense of freedom without it.
When you wrote to say that you'd done this, 12 years ago now,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
I started to think if I could do it myself and what I would miss most. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, what would I do to have some cold milk to put on a bowl of cereal in the morning, which is mm-hmm. a part of my routine? Do you take milk off the table? Is that something that you don't generally keep in your house?
I don't keep it in my house. I don't ever drink it. But, like, I'll give you an example. Maybe this past summer, half a dozen times, my wife and I said, you know what? We're going to go out and get a pint of Ben and Jerry's. You know, it's time to have it. It was a hot summer.
Yeah.
Maybe half a dozen times we did that, went out a mile away to a grocery store, came back, sat home in the evening and ate it, you know? Sure. If I need a beer once in a while, we'll go out and get one.
That was the second thing on my list, was a Saturday afternoon cold beer.
Why not?
I'm thinking to myself, now, so what will you do? Will you buy some ice and put it in a cooler and put a few beer on ice if you're having friends over?
I could, but I don't remember doing that recently. Yeah. I mean, we don't entertain with alcohol, but, you know, if we need one for ourselves or some immediate use with friends on the way home from work, we'll just pick up some, bring it home, drink it right on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm not inflexible on these things. There are times, like I said, when ice cream's nice. And
I was wondering if you consider that cheating.
No. It's not a hard, fast rule, but it's there. We do have a principle where we enjoy building our life around, and this is one that we try to accommodate most of the time. Yeah.
So do you ever walk through your house now and think to yourself, I wonder if we could do without the clock, or I wonder if we could do without this or that.
Sure.
Do you?
Yeah. I guess the next blow might come to the old computer. And I've had one in my work since, I think, my first PC was 1987. And I was late getting online till 1998. I think my kids in college forced me to because they started writing email then. And I've used it for research especially, but I'm tempted to get rid of it.
When you walk into a friend's house now, Dave, do you hear their refrigerator?
Mm-hmm. Every time. When I walked in this building, I was actually kind of congratulate you. There's not a lot of buzz in this building. I thought there might be. So
well, this is a well-designed radio studio. It's meant to be quiet.
You're right. But, I mean, even in your lobby, besides the radio. But, yes, I am always aware of extraneous noises and try to avoid them and ask myself the question, why is that there? Is it necessary? And notice other people's reaction to them. And usually it's one of accommodation. Most people are not aware of the extraneous.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not so much I tolerate it. It's more like I don't even notice it anymore.
Right.
Thanks for coming in. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
That's Dave Owen. His family lived without a television for 6 years and without a refrigerator for the past 12 years. Now, if you've managed this kind of change in your life, and if there's a story behind that change, let me know. You can go to our website and send me a note there. The website is thestory.org. Freddie Kiger was here last week to talk about finding and opening a mysterious trunk in his home.
I was, if you will, an historical Sherlock Holmes, trying to pull and piece everything together. So tremendous curiosity at first, and then the more letters I read and the more diary entries that I looked over, and the more times I saw photographs of this woman that I could clearly begin to see, I came to relate with her. At one point, Dick, I literally had all the mementos in my lap. I had just read a quote from Shakespeare about remembering one's experience, and I was so overwhelmed. I mean, I cried. And in my own twisted way, I sensed, would this be my experience 100 years down the road when someone opens the trunk, perhaps, not only to me, but for all those people in any place and part of the world who live alone?
Freddie Kiger told me that the contents of the trunk fired up his curiosity to discover who this woman, Ethel Clark Holbrook, was. And we got a lot of mail about Freddie's story. Turns out we have a number of people with a passion for this kind of genealogical research. Nan wrote from Winthrop Harbor, Illinois, to say that Freddie Kiger's story about Ethel Clark Holbrook pushed my button as a librarian, because someone who left a trunk full of documents and lived such a long time would have to have a paper trail. Did he search the census records? Did he go to the historical societies or public libraries in the towns where she lived? Please don't leave me and other listeners in suspense. Suzanne wrote in to say that she nearly had a wreck getting back home to search federal census data available via her Ancestry.com account. At the time that the 1900 and 1910 census were taken, Suzanne writes, Ethel Clark lived with her parents and siblings in Van Wert, Ohio. In the same town during the 1920s and the 1930 census, and Ethel C. Holbrook lived with her husband, Hugh H. Holbrook, and two daughters. We're zeroing in here. Carol wrote in to say that she did a little sleuthing on her own and discovered that Ethel Clark Holbrook's husband, Hugh, was a dental surgeon, that their daughters are Barbara, or maybe Helen Barbara, born in 1913, and Mary Ellen, born 2 years later. Carol also notes that there is a Mary Ellen Holbrook Barclay, wife of George T., buried in the Chapel Hill, North Carolina cemetery. She suggests that if someone can find Mary Ellen's obituary, it might list some survivors. Jim wrote from Marblehead, Massachusetts, to say that there is a new national directory of published listings, which is currently coming online. And he says what makes it different from other sites is its ability to search nationwide by first or last name. And that link is www.trajectory.com. And if all this online genealogical work doesn't pan out, Pam from Tallahassee wrote to say that she was jolted listening to the story because she heard that Ethel was from Van Wert, Ohio. And writes Pam, my father was born and raised in the farm community of Convoy, Ohio, about 5 miles outside Van Wert. He was born in 1909. Writes Pam, so he would have been roughly 20 years younger than Ethel, but this is an area that's rather small, so she writes she might be able to come up with a lead. At any rate, she says, I would be very interested in hearing the whole story. We will keep track of this, and we'll have the necessary links available to the rest of you on our website if you'd like to join in this hunt for Ethel Clark Holbrook. You can also use our website as a place to suggest other stories and to write to me about what you're hearing on the program. And if you'd rather not do this online, just call me. Our number is 1-888-966-9862, 1-888-966-9862. Just leave us your name and a number where we can get back to you. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.